Okay, good afternoon and welcome to this seminar on training pioneers and planters. Now, I've got really good news for you. The previous seminar on this channel was on building the culture of prayer, and there's been some deep intercession. The channels are open, the heavens have moved, and we're going to have a great afternoon. And so I'm going to introduce our speaker in just a moment, who will give a short talk, and then our panelists will respond to this brief of how we train pioneers and planters, and then we'll discuss together. So it'd be great if we could get as many questions as we can from you, from all of us involved in this. So if in the Q&A function, you could put all your questions and then just use the chat just to say hi and to show the parts that you're enjoying, so some appreciation, and the questions go in the Q&A function. That would be really great. But just a moment, just if you think about this topic of training pioneers and planters, I've had this time just preparing, just kind of as walking around the house making a cup of tea, thinking, wow, like all the people that have invested in me, all the people that have taken a risk on my leadership, that have trained me, I simply wouldn't be where I am today. And I didn't even introduce myself, so I'll just do that briefly. I'm Tim May, I'm the rector of Bow Church in East London, and we're having fun here. We moved here just before the pandemic, so I've been rector 2.5 times as long under COVID as without, so we're in a constant sort of time of pioneering and planting here at the moment. But I was thinking, I just wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing without those that have invested and trained me. So maybe just as we begin, let's just take a moment in silence and silently thank God and bring to mind all those that have trained and invested in us. Amen. So our speaker is Christian Selvaratnam, who we've already heard of at the conference. And Christian is the director of church planting at St Hild College and formerly at Alpha UK, where we work together. So Christian, over to you.
Hey, thanks, Tim. And it's great to be here. What a privilege to speak about this subject. I'm very aware that Tim, Ali and Lucy know so much about this as well. So let me offer a little starter for 10. And my experience of training pioneers and planters is really and mostly from my role being a church leader, most recently for 14 years at a church called G2. I have recently moved to a theological college, and so I'm involved in training from the college side of training people. So I love all the dimensions of training. But let me speak really from my experience in church leadership of raising up pioneers. And I think whereas some aspects of leadership, ministry, skills in the Christian environment can be learned from study, and I have benefited enormously personally from how study has helped me understand the ministry of God, my hunch is that pioneers are best nurtured, especially in the early stages, in a local ministry context. So my example, a church called G2 in York, one that I've just finished leading after 14 years. And we've never been a big church. At our biggest, we were 200 adults and about 50 children and youth. Nevertheless, over the last 14 years, we raised up a lot of leaders and pioneers, 13 people that went on to get ordained, more than 40 that became workers in Christian organizations. Not that that's better than working in a school or somewhere else, but it's an indication of sort of people catching a vision for God's ministry. We trained more than 100 speakers. When I left, the church had probably something like 40 people involved in leading, and many of them in very pioneering roles. Just give you a few examples. We had one student, aged 21, inherited some money from their grandmother and did what you would do. You buy an old double-decker bus, you kit it out for youth work, and you drive it around North Yorkshire evangelizing children in villages where there isn't anything else for them. What a pioneer Emily was in doing that. Two guys that came up with this crazy idea that they would spend a week outside living in a cage, and that when people asked them why they were there, they would say, because we believe that God can give freedom. Would you like to talk about Jesus? And that crazy experience actually ignited a real kind of evangelistic passion in both those guys. A first year student who was frustrated with his theology lectures, so he started a philosopher's club in a pub where he could debate the big issues of faith. I could go on, but you get the idea of pioneering in ministry. Now, let me just make one key point here, which is this. In the 14 years that we did this, I don't think we ran more than a dozen training events. And that was because our training of pioneers followed what I would call an apprenticeship model. So I'm going to just say something about that model, and I'll throw out some ideas. And it's something I've studied as well. I've studied the medieval craft guilds that for about 700 years were the way that anyone in this country in up until the Industrial Revolution would have learned any skill or trade or profession or ministry. Whether you were a butcher, a baker, a doctor, a lawyer, you would have learnt it through this gilded model, which had at its heart apprenticeship. So let me throw out four stages that were in the kind of guild model of how people were trained. And the first was apprenticeship. It begins with someone who is the master, and many of the guilds were run by men, so they were called masters. Guilds that were run by women, the leader was often called a mastress. Curious name anyway, so I'm just going to say master, but I have in mind men and women who are raising up others. And it was the master that usually selected a novice, and it was kind of like part of their skill actually to know who to ask and when. I think of the French vineyard owners that I try and visit every year to do a bit of wine tasting, and what I've discovered is they learn over years the art of knowing when to pick the grape. And actually the grape, when they pick it, is terrible. It doesn't taste of wine or even of nice grape juice, but they know the potential in that grape in front of them. They know what it can be with a timely intervention. And that's kind of the heart of the master. It's like Jesus calling his disciples. He picks people who were perhaps not up to the grade, not the cleverest or the most accomplished or anything like that, but he saw potential in them and said, hey, come with me and I'll train you as an apprentice. And the masters often had like a parental relationship with their students. It was more than just doing work together. It was a kind of holistic whole life thing. And it was an investment that took a lot of time. And often it was the master, the senior person, that was working with the newest person. I don't know what it's like in your church or ministry. Maybe the senior leader maybe only works with the next level of senior leaders. But in this model, the senior leader focused on the newbies, the newest ones in. And it's like they wanted to set the basic skills, the sort of the way to begin really well, the elementary understanding of what was happening. They wanted to lay a really good foundation that then could be built on with other things. And so I think that's just a reminder for all of us. If we've got some role in ministry, we can be calling others. We can be looking someone in the eye and saying, hey, how about you come and join me and I'll teach you something? How about I make room for you? Even just naming the potential that you see in that person who maybe doesn't have that confidence in themselves yet, but you as the master or the experienced leader, you can call that out. The second stage in this model, this kind of gilded model, was the workshop, the group environment. And actually there were different types of groups. There was the guild, there was the network, there might've been the small teams, there would have been the workshop. But the idea is learning in context. I love teaching, and I teach in a classroom, but I know pioneering is better learned in context. It's a bit like my friend who moved to France and he couldn't speak the language, but within a year he was almost fluent. And of course, because he was immersed in the context, he was in the learning environment that shaped him. And he learned about being French and how to communicate in the language. I'm sure he got there far quicker than if he just had a lot of lessons in a classroom. And so the workshop was like the second stage of drawing out the pioneering trait within someone. Certainly a place where you can get personal support and encouragement, which is vital along the way. In groups, we can be exposed to a wider range of skills. Perhaps that master that first trained us, they only know a few things. In the group, you're exposed to a wider range of skills and experiences and ideas. So it stretches you and it enlarges your environment. It teaches you teamwork and how to work with other people. It encourages that sense of deeper learning. And of course, there are different types of groups. It might be a triplet, a learning community, a workshop, a micro network, a whole gathering of everybody in the guild who's passionate about that trade. And so the second stage really in raising up pioneers is getting people into groups that draw out the pioneering that is emerging in them. The third stage is this. The German guilds called it the wandering years. And it was like the stage after the basic apprenticeship. Having learned basics, the apprentice becomes a traveling intern. And the idea is that you don't know everything, but you know enough to go and learn from others. You know enough to almost direct your next stage of self-learning. And so the idea is that you now need to travel and go to other contexts. You need to broaden your experiences of seeing something here and something here and something here. And I actually met a German stonemason who was on his wandering years. And he said his master had told him you need to go somewhere, you need to find a stonemason and you need to stay there and do day work. And you need to learn from them. They'll show you things that I didn't know. They'll show you new things. And he was told, when the dogs stop barking and when the postman knows your name, it's time to move on. And so the idea was for 3 years, he was meant to go somewhere, maybe for 3 months or 4 months, and then he was to move on somewhere else and move on somewhere else. And he was to develop a portfolio of experiences of seeing other people in his trade. And so I think the same is true for pioneering as well. You can begin in one context, but often the fullness, the maturity of that pioneering trait within you is drawn out by going to different contexts and seeing how it's done in different ministries. And it enlarges and expands your learning and your understanding. And the last stage was the apprentice finally becoming a new master or mistress. And in the ancient guilds, this was done by the presenting of a masterpiece. And the masterpiece was usually something that you made consistent with your trade that was evidence that you had understood all the basics and that you'd also sort of pulled in all this learning from your wandering years. And you would bring it together in a sort of single masterpiece, that's the name of it, that would be evidence, the proof, that you had learnt all those things. That would be your examination. So for a carpenter, it might be making a set of furniture, showing all the different joints and maybe engraving and the different skills of putting it together. For a pioneer, it might be a pioneering project or starting a church in a home or initiating a new ministry. It's evidence that you've acquired some skills of being a pioneer. And then really importantly, this stage is characterized by the fact that that person now becomes a trainer of others. In being a master, the training cycle continues by you now identifying the people that you will train and raise up, and the cycle repeats. Let me just throw in one more thing, a final epilogue of an idea to do with this guild idea of training that I think is helpful when we think of pioneers. And that is that in the guild context, creativity was incredibly important. Anyone that learned anything in the guilds was considered an artisan. If you baked bread, you were an artisan of bread. If you made furniture, you were a woodworking artisan. Everyone was an artist. The idea of being an engineer or of manufacturing is much more modern. And so this was a very artistic way of training people. And the role of the master wasn't a production line sort of thing, like, you know, like we say vicar school, or, you know, that idea that sort of everyone comes out the same. The role of the master was actually to see in what is the unique style of this student, and it's my job to nurture and to draw it out of them. So no two students could be the same. People will be developed and nurtured in different directions depending on what was observed in them, and it would be nurtured and drawn out of them. And of course, therefore, the application of their work was about creativity, which is just like being a pioneer in ministry. No two church projects or ministry events or evangelistic activities are the same. They draw on common basics, but they are inevitably assembled and put together in a bespoke and a unique way. Thank you.
Christian, thank you so much. That's fascinating. Guild, I kind of think of a kind of, I don't know, like a secret password to get in a guild. Are there secret passwords to get in guilds?
One of the things in the guilds was they were very secretive.
Yeah.
And masters would only share their deepest secrets of their trade with the people who had pledged, and there was a pledge. They'd sworn an oath to be faithful and loyal to their master. And then only then would the master say, okay, here is a secret recipe for the glue that, you know, makes really good shoes, or whatever it might have been, you know, how to make the bread.
Well, passwords, that's maybe something to consider for another year. But we're going to bring in Lucy and Ali now to respond to this theme and to bring in their insights. So Lucy first, and then Ali. Lucy, if you could just explain something of your context and reflecting on Christian's talk, your insights in training pioneers and planters.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks, Christian. That was great. So my context is sort of two hats, I think, coming to this conference, which is great. It's a great idea to get all these speakers and people coming to talk about this topic. My husband and I came out of Anglican parish church structures 17 years ago and planted what was basically a student congregation in Bristol 17 years ago. And then since then, have led small communities of young people, and we've planted two other small communities, and we're about to plant another small one. So we're just a kind of network of small communities of younger people in their 20s and 30s, which has been great, and we've absolutely loved it, but very much kind of muddling along, I would say, for many years. And really didn't have the kind of groups and things that Christian has been describing. And I look back and I think, oh, we could have so benefited, you know, from something like that. And then with my other hat on, I'm the principal of a theological college. And we made a plan about 3 years ago, just over three years ago, that we wanted actually to put together a course. And as Christian was saying, like, not to extract people out of their context as pioneers, but to feed them while they were doing what they were doing. So to find pioneers who are in the middle of doing what they're doing, who have a call to pioneer, probably in a more kind of organic way. Most of our students would fit into more of that kind of setting, and to create a program for them where they could get some kind of both theological and scriptural underpinning for kind of who they were, what they were called to, and then also in the second year to be taught by practitioners. So I was really excited to be able to put that together, especially with my background. I thought, this is the kind of thing I would have loved, you know, we would have loved to have had this if we'd had something like it. And I think it's a bit like, I was thinking, Christian, when you said that about going, when you immerse yourself in a language, and of course that is absolutely the best way to learn a language. And I was thinking that putting a theological piece and a sort of scriptural learning and doctrine and history under that or alongside it, and getting people to, giving them the chance to kind of reflect and write, It's a bit like you're immersed in France, but you also get people coming alongside you to explain the politics, explain the culture, explain the history, you know, and explain those things that make France France, that everybody in France knows why it's France, but you're the outsider, and so you, and some things you actually do need to be taught and sat down and learnt. And I think that I guess that's kind of what I see we're doing. And then you travel with your cohort for 2 years and hopefully beyond that into the years to come as you're learning to pioneer together. So I'm just, I think as much as we can do, like Christian was saying, to come alongside, you know, pioneers are so often lonely and they just, they make so many mistakes. We made so many mistakes. And if we could have just had friends and groups and people who were like, I know what you're going through. We know, you know, don't worry about it. Here, we're here. And so if I think all of us here, that's what we want to do, is we want to provide those kind of support structures and underpinning that perhaps we didn't have, you know, 20 years ago or something.
And it is just amazing that both you and Christian fit into that category of practitioner and teacher. And that's just such a gift to the church to not have to make that distinction. Ali, let's hear from you. It'd be great to hear a little bit about your context and how you respond to this. What's going on in Birmingham?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I am based at Gastry. I'm a curate there. And Gastry is in Birmingham. And we were planted, I think, about 5.5 years ago now from HTB. Originally, a team came from there. And yeah, Christian, that's brilliant. I love the this image of the guilds and the apprenticeships. I think it's fantastic, really helpful. And I was just sort of reflecting that I think probably Gastry is sitting somewhere, what we're doing is sitting somewhere between sort of stage two and stage three, I think, somewhere around there with what we're doing. So we planted three churches so far, one in Coventry, one in the Netherlands, and another one in Birmingham. And we've got three more in the pipeline at the moment. So, I think we're watching people create their masterpiece, or we're waiting to see that happen at the moment. And I've sort of seen it in two, we have sort of two stages. We have one where people are embedded with us. And Lucy, yeah, the idea of watching people make mistakes, that's what they're doing with us. Come and see what we're doing and do it a bit better next time, hopefully. Yeah, they're kind of sending them off relationally, kind of keeping that connection there. So we're really kind of taking people so far who've been ordained. So they've done a lot of theological training and then they're kind of coming to learn and watch, lead, gather, reflect, joining in. And then we're praying for them, resourcing them and supporting them in that way. So that's kind of where we're at. But it's a really helpful model, Christian. Thank you.
So we have some incredible questions coming in. I don't think we're going to quite get to them all, but there's some really, really good topics. So let's dive straight in there's a question about identifying apprentices tying into your model, Christian, but let's just broaden that out a little bit and just be great to talk about, how do we identify pioneers? What's the way we do that in your different contexts, your different insights? Should we go, Lucy, do you want to go first?
Sorry, I was looking at those questions. They're great questions. How does one identify a pioneer? I think that a lot of it is the energy that they have. You know, like Christian was describing, people who just go out and do something. And I think we all know those people, and we watch them, and we think, oh, that's great. And I would say it's partly just being alert to watching what people are actually doing. But I think as well, there is a sort of prophetic side that I would say is quite important, and that there are some people who are waiting to be called out. And I think I see that especially with often with women. Maybe older women, I think younger women are a bit freer perhaps, but you know, are just waiting for somebody to encourage and to say, we see this in you. And I think Christian mentioned that, you know, like, I see this and here's what I think your potential is. So watching people, and there's also, I would say that pioneers do need a certain level of resilience. And so I would watch for that, and I wouldn't want to throw somebody out into something that would be too difficult, you know, unless I thought that they would really enjoy it.
Ali, how do you identify pioneers and planters within Gastry? How have those three churches and three in the pipeline, how has that process worked?
Well, it's been a bit of a mix. So some of them have been people that the diocese have identified and asked that could they come and kind of spend a bit of time with us before going off to plant. And others, it's been relational mostly, actually. So people have contacted us, had a conversation, say they've got a real heart for planting. Could they come and spend some time with us? If we can kind of tie that in with what the diocese are doing and find the resources, you know, because obviously if it's a curacy, then there's got to be a specific route that happens. The guys in the Netherlands, they're not within the Anglican system. It's a bit more straightforward. But generally, it's a relational thing for us.
And Christian, the thing, you know, I think Ali and I have spoke about this before, but that dynamic of the relational thing, we were talking earlier on about how sometimes actually the system excludes people. Lucy was talking about it just there around gender. But just be interested, Christian, particularly in this identification of pioneers and planters. Those of us that might be in context with models of ordination, how do we think with ordination and beyond ordination? How do we recognise that the clerics can only do so much, and perhaps that's been part of the problem, some would say. So Christian, any thoughts on how do we move beyond what some would call over-clericalisation of the Church of England?
Yeah, I was just in the previous seminar with John McGinley, and he mapped out beautifully a description of the church where people who are not ordained would be taken much more seriously. And I love that. And I think that does need to happen. We're not going to transform the Church of England or whichever denomination you're in through the vicars alone. It will be others. I think on recognizing in others, I think you don't have to do it all in one big jump. You can do it in little steps. And I think I've learned, particularly with younger leaders, and the example Lucy gave, I found the same experience in raising up women. We used to keep a spreadsheet of how many times we'd asked women, because we knew we needed to be patient. We knew that many of them would say no the first time. And so sometimes it would usually get to four before we would have the bolder conversation of saying, no, I really want you to do this. But we recognize, so if we were lazy, we'd have asked once and then we'd have just heard, they're not interested, and given up. So I think you tend to see people like yourself. So that's the easy one to spot. You spot someone who's like you. And if you're a man, you spot men. If you're a woman, you spot women, etc. And I think with the team and with processes, I think you can make it fairer. You can say, we want to give everyone a fair opportunity to have a go, and just give people an opportunity and see what it does, see where it takes them. And then I think often there's no need for a lot of encouragement. I mean, I think one of the problems with the ordination training is we front load the thinking and then we put the practice after. And it's a very risky strategy, isn't it? I think it'd be much safer to say, how about we test people in the local church first? And then if we can really commend them, then we add the extra training, like Lucy said, you know, let's do the theory of France, etc. That can be the second phase. I think there's a danger if we start with a head knowledge and assume that alone will activate pioneering, because it may not.
And just launching off that then, someone's asked a great question. They said, do you absolutely need official theological training to be launched into ministry? The Bible doesn't seem to point to that, looking at the first disciples. Lucy, it'd be great. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks, Tim. I think it's such an interesting, I love people's questions, because it, you know, official theological training means that I think you have something in view. So you're thinking of like someone validating you by training you to do something and then saying, oh, now you've done that, so now you can do this. And no, of course, you don't need that. But would theological scriptural training, training in your in church history, in what is the church, in mission, would that help you? Yes, of course that's going to help you. And when you think about the early disciples and the early apostles, they were all taught. I mean, so forget official, let's just drop that. Do you need theological training to do mission and ministry? Of course you do. And it would be silly to think that you wouldn't have any training in the scriptures or any training in church, in what you believe, or any training in church history. And when all of the people that followed Jesus were taught by him, he taught them all. He taught them all the time. And even after he was resurrected, he taught them again for 40 days. And then they wrote down everything to teach everybody else. And then they appointed leaders and bishops to do all the teaching and the preaching. So learning our faith is essential to becoming disciples of Jesus. And would we want to do that somewhere where that is full of faith and full of the Spirit? Yes, absolutely.
Anything to add, Ali or Christian?
I just think that's sort of the perfect example, isn't it, of what we're talking about is Jesus spending time teaching with them and showing them how it's done at the same time, sort of him doing it and then going, right, you guys go and do it, like, even if it's the feeding the 5,000. And he sort of says, well, I'll break the bread, they go, now you go and actually feed them, or sending them out in their groups, and yet having the teaching, the theology sort of embedded right into that. And I think that's what we're all saying here, is actually both are really, really important, the training and the teaching and the sort of mind thinking knowledge and the practical outworking and getting on and just doing it actually.
And Tim, there's a theory in training called scaffolding, and scaffolding is anything that accelerates what the other person could do. So for me, I'll give you my example. We trained 100 preachers. I can tell you how we did it. We asked hundreds of people, but then we said, we'll work with you on your talk. So they don't have to go away to college before they can do the talk. They can say, this is my idea. Can you help me? And then you're the scaffolding that helps them, you know, present the best version of that talk. And if there was anything, you know, that theologically needed to be tightened up or improved, and actually I found rarely was that the case, then actually you can add that to them. You can be the one that activates that in them. And then, you know, that's how they grow. And then eventually they might say, now I want that learning for myself. And perhaps the best reason for them to do that is so that they could train others as well. So I think if we think team, we can do a lot with relying on each other for that kind of help.
Thank you. And Ali, could I ask you this question about family? And it's about relocating and planting and the disruption that causes to families. And just, you know, you're sending people to Coventry, I think you said Netherlands, right, all over. And I know that you've done an awful lot of thinking about families. So what would be your reflections on, particularly in this training process and pre-move, and how do we think through families? And does, as this question says, does the whole system need a rethink overhaul?
Probably all systems need rethinking all the time, don't they? It's funny you asked that actually, because we literally our sort of next planter has just moved house last week and got her kids, settling them into a new school. You know, just went round to visit them, the house in kind of chaos as they're unpacking boxes and things, and just remembering, just thinking, oh my, this is like, it's huge, isn't it? When you move somewhere, it is a really, really big deal with the family. So there is definitely a cost to it. Just to say, we didn't randomly send people off to the Netherlands. They were actually from the Netherlands in the first place. So we're not that, you know, kind of off you go, although it's always possible. There is a cost, but I guess the ideal is that you do move somewhere and then you really do get embedded, plugged in, connected with your context, with the community. And I know, you know, I've read a lot of stuff from Eugene Peterson, who's a bit of a hero of mine, his thing about very much being in a context for a long time. And you know, just building the relationships there, growing to know your context, like being in, you know, being in France and learning the context, it does take time. So I guess the ideal is that you're not dragging your family around the country every year or so. However, with the caveat that that might be the call on certain specific people, but I believe that God would call a family together in that case, that people would have, you know, conversations with their kids about that, that God would be speaking to the children as well as to the adults in that case. But I think the ideal is, yeah, that you don't move, you know, every few months or whatever, that you can get plugged into a context for a decent amount of time. We've moved a couple of times in the last 6 years, and it's tough. But the ideal is to stay for a little while now.
Thank you so much. We're actually amazingly almost coming to the end of the seminar. It'd be really good if each of you could just give maybe just a final bit of advice or thoughts, or really in terms of what you're up to, something of the vision or hope that you have for training pioneers and planters. Christian, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think my encouragement would be every one of us can do something immediately. We've all got a space that we can make some room for someone, and we can all, you know, find a quiet moment and sit and pray and have a think about the people we know and think, who could I make room for? Or maybe you ask, who am I overlooking? Who have I not recognized? Who might I... We used to have a phrase in our church that we don't say somebody's no for them. So I don't, you know, oh, they wouldn't want to. No, why don't I look them in the eye and say, hey, would this be of any interest to you to join me in doing this? And my experience from the examples I've given is it's amazing how far that can go. It's amazing how much it can be. It can activate. Many people will know Miriam Swaffield, and she got to preach first in our church. And something she said I never forgot, which is she said, loads of people have told me, oh, you'd probably be a great preacher. She said, when I came to this church, you said the same. And then you said, would you like to do 5-minute talk 2 weeks from now? So we can tend to sort of, we can activate it. We can say, hey, I've got something for you. It's a small opportunity. It's a first step. I'm going to make room for you and see where it goes.
And Ali, what about you?
Yeah, I think all the same, but I just think it's around encouragement. Who can you encourage? How can we give people confidence? How can we speak into their lives? How can we pray for them prophetically, pray in the power of the Spirit, and just support people. And it's probably been quite clear, I'm quite about the relationship and like making those kind of one-to-one connections and listening and helping people reflect. But yeah, the kind of undergirding of that is probably the encouragement would be key.
It's interesting when you talk about encouragement. I was reflecting on a few situations that I'm in at the moment and how we give up quite easily, don't we, with people. There's sort of two schools of thought, aren't there, that you invest in those that are kind of give a good return quickly and you keep on going. But it's amazing. I've seen recently people that I haven't given up on, people that maybe walked away from faith or gone through particularly challenging life circumstances. And I think to see the kind of things happen that we've dreamt and prayed about today, we're going to need people from all sorts of extraordinary backgrounds. And even what Christian was saying there about the sort of the earlier on about the perseverance, asking people 4 times, I think we often go for the easy fruit, but it isn't always the most transformative fruit. And Lucy, finally, you, what do you wrap up? Any last thoughts for us?
Yeah, well, I love what the other two said, and I just to add to it, really, I would say find yes people. You know, surround yourself with yes people. I think they lift your spirits and, you know, spur you on, whether you're the pioneer or you're raising up pioneers. And I think a faith-filled environment, you know, there's a lot of fear around and a lot of fears that people have. And actually, to be pioneers, we need to be faith-filled and to fill one another with the faith that all things are possible with God. You know, nothing's impossible with him. And I think being around those people just gives you this big horizon that you think we could do this, you know, as a group. And I see great hope for the church in this nation and globally. And I love hearing stories of what God's doing. And I think if we're storytelling, faith-filled people, you know, we will call that out in each other.
Thank you. If you're around at the beginning of the seminar, I asked us to take a moment to think about who's invested in us, who's trained us, who's made us who we are. And maybe we could just take a moment at the end of this seminar to think about who's God calling us right now to invest in. What's the conversation that we need to have with someone to encourage them to do a course at somewhere like WTC or to offer them the microphone to preach? So let's just take a moment and just think about who we're going to invest in, what conversations we're going to have following this. Wonderful. Well, it's 3 o'clock. Thank you, Christian, Ali and Lucy. And thank you, everyone, for being involved. All your comments and questions. Sorry we couldn't quite deal with them all. But there's always more to learn, isn't there? And if you stay in this channel, the next seminar is on buildings, finances and legal, all the nitty gritty. And if you're staying, I'll see you in 10 minutes for that. But if not, have a great afternoon. Thanks, everyone. Bye.